This Veterans Day will feature many events honoring the people who serve our country in the armed forces, and the events extend into the weekend, including the induction of new members into the Oregon Aviation Hall of Honor. That's at the Evergreen Air and Space Museum in McMinnville, close to Portland. Our first guest is both the former executive director of the museum and a member of the Aviation Hall of Honor. Larry Wood is a retired Marine colonel. He spent more than three decades flying fighter jets and other planes and training other people to fly them as well. And he's our guest in the exchange today. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Tell us first what the Hall of Honor is and give us a little history on it.
Well, the Hall of Honor is an opportunity to recognize people that contributed to aviation from the state of Oregon or that are kind of associated with the state of Oregon. So it, not only do you need to have been a pilot and or somebody tied to aviation, but you have to continue to contribute to educational, particularly education, here in the state of Oregon over a long period of time. So there's a lot of very interesting and very famous people in there, like Marion Carl, and a few others like that, Mr. Smith, Delford M. Smith that founded Evergreen, and other people like that. It's kind of an interesting collection.
And it was actually created by a state department, is that right?
Yeah, the Oregon Department of Aviation created it some years ago and didn't have a home for it, so Mr. Smith offered our theater, and that's where it's been located since.
Does Oregon have a particularly rich tradition in aviation?
Oh, yes. Are you kidding? It goes back, clear back, almost to Orville and Wilbur, but not quite. Some very interesting characters are Oregonians that flew and did some famous things. One of them flew his airplane through the blimp hangars over in Tillamook and some other exotic stuff like that. But there's there's some newspaper men in there that pushed aviation into the state. Oregon's a great place for home builds and other stuff like that. So we're kind of an interesting place for aviation.
Absolutely. The blimp hangar alone is a story in itself. I should point out that is not the size of a plane hangar. It's a huge enclosed space, and so it's not entirely impossible, obviously, that a plane could fly through it.
Oh, no. It's very, very large, and it's pretty slick inside.
So let me understand. The people in the Aviation Hall of Honor, they're not necessarily all military. There's a bunch of military in there, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of military in there, but there's some civilians, a newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the gentlemen that we're inducting this year is Dennis Overholster. And Dennis was actually instrumental in the Lockheed Skunk Works in the development of the F-117 stealth fighter.
Oh, okay. So he helped create the plane, but not a throttle jockey himself.
No.
let's talk about some of the other people in there. Rex Barber, for example, did what?
Oh, Rex Barber is one of the gentlemen involved in the interception of Admiral Yamamoto. Admiral Yamamoto was the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor and a very prompt and timely man. And we knew when he was coming to Bougainville, and he was met by 16 P-38s. And Rex Barber is the man now credited with having shot down Yamamoto's airplane.
Wow, that is an amazing. And he's from, is it Medford?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, yeah, we're just talking about making sure that the old airfield where he used to fly in was got a monument, which it will get this weekend as well.
Oh, yes.
All kinds of fun stuff. Lawrence Campbell, also enshrined in the Aviation Hall of Honor. What's he known for?
Oh, now you got me.
Oh, really?
Remember,
okay.
I don't know all of them. Okay. There's about 50 of them.
Okay. How about Jake DeShazer? Now, there's an amazing
story. Oh, yeah. Jake DeShazer, he's one of the one of the guys that did the Doolittle raid on Tokyo. He's a Tokyo raider.
Mm-hmm.
Raider. Continued education as a missionary to Japan and all kinds of other stuff. Very, very interesting and colorful man.
I understand too that he actually converted as a minister. One of
yes.
the people who was involved with leading the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. There's some amazing stories there in the Oregon Aviation Hall of Honor. We're talking to Larry Wood about it. He's a retired Marine colonel and somebody actually in the Aviation Hall of Honor, and he is the former executive director of the Evergreen Air and Space Museum, which contains the Hall of Honor. If you have some stories to share about Oregon aviation history or some of the people we've talked about here today or people you know are in the Hall of Honor, share those with us. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You had 31 years active duty in the Marines, is that right?
Well, yeah, that's what my DD-214 says.
Okay, what do you say?
Well, it's actually 30 years, 11 months, and 15 days. That's close enough.
But who's counting, right?
Yeah, right. Well, they count.
So was your training unusual for its time, Larry?
Well, yeah, and it's still unusual even for this time. I was one of the first guys that got sent to Air Force pilot training. Normally, Marine pilots go through Navy pilot training and become naval aviators. Well, I went through Air Force pilot training because during the Vietnam War, the Navy couldn't pump out enough pilots, so the Air Force had a lot bigger system. So we went there. And when I got out of that, then I went to Cherry Point, North Carolina, and got another 60 flight hours to bring me up to the same standard as the Navy guys. Mostly, I didn't get to go to the ship like they did, but that we did that later. And so my wings were pinned on me, my Navy wings were pinned on me in October of 1968. And one of the guys in the Hall of Honor, Marion Carl, that I mentioned before, actually pinned my wings on. And General Carl was a World War II hero, a very dynamic fellow. And when he put my wings on me, he looked at me and said, "You know, Lieutenant, normally this is done by a very pretty girl." And I said, "Yes, General." And he said, "And no, I'm not going to kiss you." And I said, "Thank you, General."
It seems like sort of informal banter for such a solemn ceremony.
Well, yeah, but, you know, only he and I can hear this. There's nobody else within yards of us.
Okay. It sounds fun. What kinds of planes did you fly, Larry?
Well, in the pilot training, I flew T-37 and T-38 just like all the Air Force guys did. Mm-hmm. But I started flying the A-4 then in 1968, and I continued to fly the A-4, the Skyhawk. It's a little tiny single-seat, single-engine airplane until 1992. The airplane actually was accepted by the Marine Corps 1st Marine Squadron was 1956, and the last Marine Squadron was 1994. So we got our money's worth out of that little guy.
Wow, no kidding. That's a long time for a military plane to be in service,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So I have time in the A-4B, the C, the E, the F, the J, the M, and what would have been the Y, but the Marines liked the M so much they kept the M on it.
Huh. So how? What kinds of missions did you fly?
Well, it's an attack airplane, so most of those were ground attack sorties. And then in Vietnam, you know, I did ground attack for the first 5 months I was there. And the second 5 months, I was what was called a fast forward air controller. And we flew around at high speed at low altitude, working with the slow facs, as we call them, who were up high. They were above 8,000 feet, so the small arms couldn't hit them. And they would find things, and we would go look at them closer at high speed, trying to keep from getting shot. And there's actually one of the SLOFAC airplanes is in our museum. It was actually involved in the rescue of Bat 21, which is a movie that came out about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about, I mean, I have to ask any Vietnam veteran about this, because obviously we've gone through quite a bit of convolutions in our national psyche about how we feel about that war. What do you make of it all now?
Well, you know, you got to remember, I was a lieutenant, so it was kind of a go do what you're told and shut up type of thing. But, the difficulty with history is you have to look back from a long time afterwards to really see what worked out. And so the common T-shirt that you see on a lot of guys my age is, "We were winning when I left."
Uh-huh.
And if you look back at the world today, you know, they're an ally, essentially, and they have a very much open society, significantly more open than it was before. Certainly, they have a much, much more capitalistic economy than they would have ever had before. So who won? It's a good question, and we'll never know, and it's not important anyway. I think most of the people that served in Vietnam were proud to have served. And if you talk to them, they'll tell you that. Look, I did what I was supposed to do, and it worked. I'm a lucky guy because I got welcomed home, and that's another one of those goofy stories.
Hmm.
The squadron commander of one of the squadrons that was in the same air group I was in was a guy named Keith Smith. And Keith Smith brought his squadron back across the Pacific in 1970. Transpac is what we call it. Flew all the way back to El Toro. And they got to El Toro about 2 or 3 days before I got there. And I came home by ship. So we landed, essentially an assault craft in Camp Pendleton. Fortunately, there's a boat ramp at Del Mar, so I didn't have to wade ashore. That would have been kind of exciting. And as I came up the ramp, I heard this voice say, "Welcome home, Woody." And it was Keith Smith. He had 25 of his Marines and two of his officers on that ship. And he was up there with his entire family, having just gotten home 2 days before, to welcome those guys back. And that's a Marine Corps thing. And I've always had this terrific feeling in my heart for Keith Smith, who retired, by the way, as a lieutenant general and has passed away a couple years ago, as what a great man that was to take the time to come welcome 20 kids out of the 300 that worked for him home.
Larry Wood, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange on this Veterans Day, a retired Marine colonel. We're talking about his experiences in the military and about the fact that he is a member of a pretty select group as part of the Aviation Hall of Honor in the state of Oregon, which is attached to the Evergreen Air and Space Museum, where Larry was also previously the executive director. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I've been dying to ask this question since I first saw some of the pictures of the cockpits on these single-engine things like the Skyhawk. Not a lot of creature comfort, I gather.
Now, I'm still not a very big guy, but I was the right size to fly the airplane, 5'10", 180 pounds, 175 pounds. And there are switches back there that once you got in, you could never see, but fortunately they're different shapes, so you could reach back and by feel tell what they're doing. The common thing about the A4 is you didn't get in it, you put it on. And it was the last analog airplane, as it's frequently described. You didn't have to vote with a computer to fly it. There wasn't any computer. There was just you. Huh. And very maneuverable little airplane. The Blue Angels flew them for a long period of time. Full stick deflection to the left gave you a roll rate at 720 degrees a second. Think about that.
That's two full rotations a second?
Yes. So it's pretty rapid roll.
Wow, no kidding.
And the airplane, Ed Heinemann built the airplane for the Douglas Company, and the one restriction that he had was not to change the wingspan. You could do anything you wanted, but it had to stay 27 feet 6 inches from one wingtip to the other wingtip. And that was so there didn't have to be a fold mechanism to put it on the old aircraft carriers so that they could get it up and down in the elevator without folding the wings. And he said, there's no wing fold. We're not going to do that because that would add weight. Add complexity. Every pound you added to the structure of the airplane, you had to add 10 pounds of gas, et cetera, et cetera. So the Navy said, we want an attack airplane that weighs less than 30,000 pounds empty, and Ed Heinemann built him one that weighed less than 8,000 pounds empty.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's some serious engineering, right down to the nickel, It sounds like. You can't be claustrophobic and be a military pilot, I'm guessing.
Well, you got a bubble over your head. You remember your head sticking up in the clear sky there in that canopy. Don't talk to me about submarines. I'm never going to do that.
Okay, fair enough. You worked as a flight instructor too, Larry. Can anybody be taught to fly?
I was once asked that question, and I said, with enough bananas, I could teach an ape to fly, but he wouldn't know how to handle an emergency procedure, and that's the secret. You know, it's not difficult to fly in itself. The hard part is to do something constructive with the airplane and also to take care of the airplane and yourself when something goes wrong. That's the difficult part to learn. It's pretty simple to make the airplane go up, down, sideways, etc., but making it do something efficient and well is difficult.
So how many planes are contained at that Evergreen Air and Space Museum that contains the Aviation Hall of Honor?
Okay, about 135 is the last number, and we just got a couple new ones, so it changes pretty regularly. The principal airplane, of course, is the Spruce Goose, the world's biggest wooden airplane, and actually right now has the world's longest wingspan, 320 feet.
Wow, that's still a major draw, obviously. This is Howard Hughes' flying boat.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of challenges is it to get people to come to museums in a time of infinite entertainment right in your hand?
Well, the trick is to get them to come a second time. Most people will come once to see what's here, and particularly kids, okay? Kids of this particular generation want to be able to touch something, and they want something to happen, and they want it to happen right now. They're not going to read a sign attached to an airplane. They want to know about that airplane. So even the National Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian, is having difficulty with that particular thing because, you know, you're not supposed to touch artifacts in a museum. So you got to work with things like cell phones and other things like that. So you have one of those codes in the corner of the thing, and you can click on it with your cell phone, and it will tell you more about tell you more about the airplane. You also want flight simulators. You want something that a kid can get his hands on and can either try to make it fly or, you know, land on the moon or whatever. And so that's electronic stuff, which is fun and horrifiably unreliable. So, yeah, that's the problem, is to get it to work, get a kid to be involved with it, a young person in particular, and then keep it working.
We should point out you have some experience trying to keep kids interested, because you did teach middle school for a few years after coming out of the Marines. So I have to ask this, which is harder, dead stick landing a fighter jet or trying to get a room full of middle school boys to pay attention at 2:55 in the afternoon?
Well, people always ask that, and what I always say is, in the Marine Corps, the troops knew I could put them in jail for 30 days. The middle school kids knew I couldn't, okay? And that's a difference. I loved middle school kids, and people say, you're nuts. And I said, no, because they're young enough that when you did something really slick, the light bulb would come on, and you'd see them go, ooh, that's cool. Now, they wouldn't say it was cool, but they'd really you'd get their attention. High school kids are too cool to be attracted by anything like that. But middle school kids were kind of fun. And generally speaking, they would get along, as long as you remember that part of being a teacher is being an entertainer. You know, it's one of those, you got to be able to tap dance, sing, and three or four other things all at the same time to keep their attention span. And I had fun doing it.
It sounds like it. You really have a sound in your voice like that. Just a couple seconds left here, Larry. When is the Hall of Honor induction this weekend?
The Hall of Honor is on Sunday in the AV in the theater here at the Evergreen, and it starts at 1 o'clock, 1 to 3.
All right, that's 1 p.m., the Oregon Aviation Hall of Honor, of which Larry Wood, the retired Marine colonel, is already a member. He is also the former executive director of the Evergreen Spare Air and Space Museum, which houses the Oregon Aviation Hall of Honor. Lots of hats off and on. Larry Wood, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
All right, take care.